A Always BBC recording. Ahoy, ahoy.
I am no one's flying monkey.
You are so his flying monkey.
No.
Oh my God.
No.
Well, I tend to side with John on these things. I admire his logic. Meat moop.
Well,
give me a break.
Never. Ever.
You know what I do, Todd? I'm like an animal. I turn over on my back and I show my vulnerable side. I could be very brave. Boy, I kick the crap out of people all the time. I'm a big shot. I'm always getting in fights.
Is he even on? Is he here?
No, he's shunning us.
Jeez. Summer, thanks for having me on your podcast. Digga.
Hello. How's it going, John Syracuse? You there?
Mm-hmm.
Hi. Hi, and welcome to our very special third annual Relay member episode. And we are joined, John and I are joined this week by our very good friend, friend of the show, Todd Vaziri. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
Isn't this nice, John? Isn't it nice to have Todd here?
It is nice.
Do you have any opening remarks?
I don't. Does Todd have any opening remarks?
Yeah, that's a good question, Todd. Do you have any opening
remarks? Hold on, let me get out my binder.
Well, is there anything you wanted to ask us, or do you have any questions about how we do this?
I've been taking notes for the last few years, so let's see here. I got my bullet point. No, do I have anything to ask you guys?
We have so much to ask you.
When I'm listening to the podcast in Overcast, I'm just shouting at my iPhone while it's playing. You guys can't hear that?
Why don't you agree with John?
No. I'm usually yelling things like thank you for talking about this. I mean, particularly like the parenting stuff and the media stuff. And, you know, when you guys have arguments or disagreements. Oh, wait, I don't even know how to say it the right way. When there's conflict,
Sometimes we're just interrogating an idea together.
You're just asking the question. But no, I'm a big giant fan of your show. When you guys debuted it, I didn't know what it was going to be like, and it's different than anything I could have imagined, and I really like it. I just really, really look forward to each and every episode.
For a while there, you were starting to feel like the Brian Epstein of the show. Like you were in practically every episode, and I imagine that was kind of upsetting.
It was very painful, and thank you for acknowledging
it. You ever do that? Somebody mentioned you on the podcast, you ever did I was expecting that. It's very upsetting.
Well, or I get a text from somebody and they say, oh, you're mentioned on the blankety blank. And I'm like, oh, I start to sweat.
Does that give you anxiety when that happens?
Everything gives me anxiety.
Hmm.
What do you think people are saying about you that's bad?
Oh, I got a binder for that.
we don't know enough dirt to say bad things about you yet.
Yeah, you don't hang out with me enough. You just got to hang out a little bit longer. No. There's plenty.
I'm just so good at immediately jumping. First of all, I jump to the immediate worst possible thing that it could be. And then I pause a moment to figure out how I'm probably impoverished in my imagination about how much worse it could actually be.
Yeah.
Do you ever do that?
Oh, yeah. It's bad. Because I feel guilty about things about, you know, when you have a choice to make. And you have seven different options, let's just say, of major choices, the paths you can go down. I feel guilty about the paths that were not even remotely an option. I feel guilty that I even thought of those things. And I do a real number on myself sometimes. So I'm turning over a new leaf. I'm trying to think the best of what others think of me or care less about what others think of me. Hey, there you go. How about that? Care less.
I think it's a really good idea. You know, it's funny to me because you always
put on a t-shirt.
You strike me as somebody who is the kind compliment is that you're humble, but you strike me as somebody who sometimes we're getting deep fast, but maybe even has like a little bit of imposter syndrome. Like given how successful you are in your career and how beloved you are as a character and creator, you seem to be pretty tough on yourself about that.
There's no question about it. I mean, I just did the, let's see, I looked at like, I'm in my 17th year at the company that I wanted to work for when I was a kid, you know, and I still think at any moment, somebody's going to tap me on the shoulder and go, hey, we figured you out.
Some guy in a boxy suit's just going to come in and go, we found out.
Yeah. Just pack your stuff. Forget about it, Vaziri. I don't know how you got through for so long. So, you know, it's always there. And I don't know, at least from a creative, artistic perspective, a little bit of that is good because it I don't know. It means I'm hungry. It means I'm still challenging myself. I go into dailies, you know, almost every day, and I'm nervous to show my shot every day to people that I've known now for literally decades. And it's, I don't know. I guess it means the system's working, because I'm really, you know, ultimately proud. You know, people seem to like work with me, and I'm proud of what I was able to do. But you know, at any moment it could go crashing down when that guy taps me on the shoulder.
Don't you think Todd should introduce himself for the people who don't know him as a beloved character?
Beloved character
from this podcast.
Yeah, Todd's a beloved character that I feel like I got to know you through Twitter and what became, you know, the usual way through mutual friends. It's funny to open with talking about like why you would feel bad about yourself. Could you, for the listeners, for the five or six people who don't know, could you tell people what you do, what your background is, and how we came into this circle and how you came to feel so bad about yourself? What even do you do?
I guess my business card, if I had one, would say I'm an artist and a lead at Industrial Light and Magic visual effects company. And I've been there, this is my 17th year, and I worked in Los Angeles for a little while before that in visual effects on movies. And before that, I wrote about visual effects on the internet. That was starting in like 94, 95. I was still in college, and I was writing essays about movies and visual effects, a little bit of sound effects, a little bit on stunts, but mostly visual effects. And when I worked in Los Angeles, I realized I could not write any more visual effects because I'm now in the system. There's a bit of a, you know, conflict of interest, or, you know, I can't do the type of editorializing that I was doing before I entered the industry. And then, but I always kept my toe in writing about movies and visual effects. And then when I got to ILM, I was like, well, there's definitely nothing I can do anymore. I have to stop writing altogether. But for some reason, I kept writing about it. And Twitter is really interesting because I was blogging for a long time. And then I would want to write so badly about something. But I would want to write a fantastic article. And that article would take like months and months to get right. Twitter's great because you could just write a couple characters and it doesn't force you to, it's obviously a little bit more ephemeral, and I got used to being able to express an opinion about something in a much, you know, smaller character count. And I don't know, it really fit for me in terms of like me trying to do whatever the heck it is that I do to try to talk to people about visual effects and movies and stuff like that. And I blog a lot less now that I'm on Twitter, and
you still do. You were the master of threading before that became a thing. I mean, you've got to be up there with Darth in terms of like the, oh my God, I can't believe he's going back to this thread from this many months ago, whether that's an update on something that you ate or some kind of an effect that you admire. You did that with Storyfy for a long time.
Yeah,
put those threads together. Weren't you on the Vanguard? Were you on the Vanguard of figuring out Trump's phone? Was that you?
That was me, yeah. Yeah.
Those were the good old days when you could tell.
That was a little crazy.
That got away from you a little bit. That got big.
I got to say, that like 2 days after I tweeted that and it went completely crazy, I was almost about to delete the tweet because I just did not want to deal with any of the Trump people anymore. Not that I'd said anything wrong.
You stated that you can tell that when it's sent from an Android phone, it's Donald Trump. And when it's sent from an iPhone, it's not Donald Trump.
Right.
And it was true for months. And it became very clear. People went in and did like forensics on the style and the word usage, the length of the words. And it was hilarious. It was like nobody could tell. It was like somebody was holding a finger under their nose to be a fake mustache. You could totally tell just from the tweet.
Yeah, that was a wild time. But that was a big one. But the threading, I gotta say, the threading started with just me not wanting to repeat myself, because I would always search to see if I've tweeted about this before. And then if I did tweeted something even remotely in that sphere, I would just add, you know, reply to that tweet. So it kind of keeps a little thread going. And it's like a long-term blog post, if you think about it that way, over a long period of time. I don't know. I'm nobody's ever told me that it bothers them. So I'm just going to keep doing it. You know, I could see if it clutters up your timeline. I really wouldn't want that to happen for people, but I don't know. I like it. And it started with just me wanting to make sure I didn't repeat myself.
Does it bother you that that all this information is like distributed across tweets on a platform you don't really control? Like a lot of it, I feel like, is good information. I know I could never find it if you didn't retweet it. And I feel like it's kind of like your best content is hidden on this platform that doesn't make it easy for other people to find it in the form that you would want them. Like, do you have a separate document or something that copies all the tweets or collects them? I know Storify was filling that, but that's just another third party service. It's like, do you have all this in your blog somewhere or in a text file somewhere?
I started out doing that. I started out just embedding the tweets, which even if Twitter went away, apparently the embed would still work. Like, I've noticed that when I embedded tweets onto a blog of somebody who deleted all their tweets, the text of the tweet is still there. It still exists in the blog. So I started doing that, and boy, did that get really clunky really fast. And I realized, wow, I did all this work to make this Twitter thread about a movie thing that I liked. And then I have to like spend as much time, if not more, trying to archive it. So the short answer to what you're saying is no. I mean, other than I do download my Twitter archive from time to time, which is an offline, you know, way of seeing all your tweets. Storify was great because I was able to, you know, add all those tweets all together in addition to text and images and just further, you know, making it kind of like a blog post kind of thing. And then Storify went under and transferred all my stuff to Wakelet. And now I'm just trying to use Twitter Moments. And but to your main point is, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that, like I just said, how great ephemeral Twitter is. It's of the moment. But when I do those, like I just did one yesterday, 2 days ago, about this shot from True Lies. And it's a shot that I love. And I just did, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 tweets about it. If I don't remember that I did it and I don't, like, retweet it every once in a while, which probably annoys people too. It's kind of just lost into the ether until I remember it and add to the thread or something. So it does put me a little bit at unease, and it's something I should probably consider.
For people who don't follow Todd, shame on you, but let me explain what we're talking about here. He does tweet threads, usually explaining some about visual effects, but it's not just a bunch of text that, like, you should just collect that text in a paragraph. Each one usually has a picture or a series of pictures or an animation explaining what it is that he's talking about, because he's talking about movies a lot of the time. And it would make, in the old world, it would make for, like, a traditional blog post.
If one had, text, for example, like a VFX blog, is it the kind of thing you put on a blog?
A couple lines of text, an image, some more lines of text, an animation. Like, but it's broken up into tweets. So each tweet has some text and some image. So it's not as simple as just remembering what you typed and saving it. It's a multimedia experimentation or experience. And I'm wondering, does the offline tweet archive thing, does it save the images, or are you still relying on Twitter's hosting of those images for you?
You know what, in terms of the GIFs and the images and stuff, no, I'm hanging on to all that stuff. It I don't think you get that in the archive, I'm pretty sure. But when it's a GIF that I've, like, really worked hard on, I absolutely positively save that.
Sometimes I think about that. I watch your tweets and I'm like, he had to go and get this thing in some digital form, and then he had to scrub around in it and find the section that he wanted, then he had to extract it, then he had to run it through a thing and convert it to a GIF, or then he had to mark it up and point to the thing and slow it. It's a tremendous amount of work, and so you're keeping that around, but once you're keeping that around, don't you also want to keep the text around too?
I really should. You're doing a very good job of guilting me into thinking about this.
The trend line is not promising on a number of fronts. I mean, it's been clear for a long time that through a variety of decisions, Twitter has made, it's clear that they want you to see the latest thing on your timeline now and not worry too much about stuff that's come out before.
Sure.
And I think that's expressed, the thing that starts making this difficult is it's still fairly hard to find stuff. I haven't done the Boolean stuff in a while. They used to have pretty good Booleans for being able to zero in. I think you can still do that. They do not make it easy. They do a lot of stuff with filtering and search at this point. So clearly they don't want you to do that. And I think they feel really the same way about stories, where like for a while I was doing that bit about the Eric Trump, my father tweets, and I was trying to keep those all in one place. I couldn't find it. I would have to go in and do these canny booleans just to find that. I don't know where the story lives. I don't know if I have an area I can go to see all my stories. I probably can. But like they really, it's clear that they don't want this to be a medium whose individual content endures, forms a line. You know what I mean? Even though so many, like on political Twitter, so many people use it that way. But I think their decisions in design clearly point toward not wanting you to be able to do that.
And now, even if they don't, you know, aren't pushing you in that direction, which they always have, you know, it's always been about what's happening right now. There's a giant trend of everybody just, you know, if you're an active user, there's a movement of people going, you know what, just delete your tweets from the past.
I'm starting to see the appeal.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I obviously it comes through that I do take great care in like these kind of how to things or why this shot is special to me or, you know, those historical types of, tweet threads. I take a great care in them and I should, you know, not consider that my only spot for that should live.
Great. Now you've got homework from the podcast. Mm-hmm. Starting with taking all those images that you save. Because I think the reason you save the animations and the screenshots is because they're just such a pain to get and make. They're so time consuming. It would feel bad to upload them to Twitter and then just throw them away, so you keep them.
You know, when it goes on Twitter in such a degraded format, like the best JPEG is going to get smashed down so hard.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Especially when you're trying to demonstrate something, you have to do it as like a GIF animation. It's not ideal.
Don't they turn everything into a movie automatically?
Yeah, it's not a GIF. Yeah, they immediately recompress it, which even early on, like I worked really hard on this. You know, that scene in The Shining where Jack Torrance is trying to break down the door with the axe. That wonderful
the motion
whip pan, that the camera does. It's almost like it's on a bungee cord and it just snaps just like in the pan. I made a seamless loop of that. And I was really proud of that. And I, you know, okay, the GIF is working. And then I uploaded it to Twitter. And there was a one frame pause on the loop frame. So you could always tell where the loop was. And I'm like, okay, I'm just deleting that. I don't want people to see that. They had since fixed that. But they immediately convert it to some kind of MP4 or something like that.
Yeah, like when you're trying to show like the Back to the Future thing, Back to the Future Part 2, showing where the matte lines were between like the two different shots and how they had to move it. No, this was like a motion control camera where they do one shot with one side of Doc Brown and the other shot with the other side, and then they combine them. Mm-hmm. And they had to move the dividing line because of like some frozen breath issues. Anyway, you're trying to show what is a pretty subtle effect. Like, you have to explain in the tweet, look at the sign here and look how it moves a little bit. And then it's just so massively compressed by Twitter that it just turns it all
into mud. And I'm brightening it up. I'm gammaing it up. I did the rock and roll on it so that it loops back and forth. I've specifically shown you the tiny frame range that I want you to see. And still, like, it's compressed so much that the GIF looks beautiful. And I could embed a link to the GIF. But no,
the GIF doesn't look beautiful. We want like HD Vimeo, like full res. That's what true, VFX tweeting should be. But alas.
I'd argue that would, you know, one extra click, one extra tap that opens up YouTube, that opens up another thing.
You can't do it. I'm saying like it's Twitter. Yeah. Another reason that Twitter is not the ideal platform for what you're trying to demonstrate, but you can usually show it, especially like when you, what was the one where you're messing with like the gamma controls or something else to show the areas that are blacked out.
Oh, that was another Back to the Future 2, probably wire removal, where there was a soft mat at the top of the screen with that. The black levels just didn't match perfectly. You kind of would never notice if your TV is calibrated properly. But if you crank up the brightness of your TV, there's this big giant softball mat that's up there.
Now that I've got you here, can you explain the Return of the Jedi one that you did?
Oh, the Luke's hand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you trying to say with that one? You're trying to say that, like why would they do anything having to do with his hand in that shot?
Because when they filmed that as a pickup, the actor was not wearing a glove. So that is a roto shape that somebody did to fill in with black to make it seem like he was wearing a black glove. So
this is an example where the compression of Twitter didn't help me, because I looked at the original, like, here's what it looked like, and here it is enhanced, right?
Right.
And in the original, I couldn't see anything by the hand. Like, it was totally, like, just muddy, dark blob of, like what are they even doing there? And then the mask, I could see they did something on the hand. But so I guess what you're saying is if they didn't do that, the hand would look like muddy flesh and shadows instead of muddy black and shadows.
It's I get that was one of, I was not being Professor Todd at that moment. I was being more like cheeky, like I'm going to be a little more playful, and you all figure it out kind of thing. You're right, John. It wasn't good enough. Jeez.
We talked about.
I need things to be explained, because I'm not sure.
Is this
I'm
seeing even what I'm episode to be or an odd episode?
I forget which we're even on. These are not canonical. Jeez. I think Chewie gets a medal in this one.
This is out of the sequence. It has no number. Only letters.
I just introduced my daughter to Robot or Not, and we were listening to Is Darth Vader a Robot? And there's one point where you said something like, you know, if only there was some way to show the genesis, you know, of this character and whether he's a cyborg. And she turned to me and grinned, and she's like, is he the one that didn't tell his kid about the prequels? I'm like, yeah, he's the one. She thought it was hilarious.
Took me a while to let the kids know about the prequels. Yeah.
Really?
They've seen The Phantom Menace, and eventually they're going to see, you know, the other two.
He hates it. It gets everywhere.
Show your kids the special features featuring you?
You know what? No, because I don't want to spoil what they can enjoy from the film.
Mm. I'm covered with shame.
They love watching the original trilogy.
Did you work
trilogy.
On all three of those?
No, just 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
I like 3. But they like the new ones, and they've seen all the new ones, and they know that before they could watch those PG-13 new ones. I was like, oh, they can't watch any of my Star Wars movies. No, it's fine. They know.
See,
we
talked about this.
Does.
You're a good dad. You're a proper dad. You don't show terrible things to your children like I do.
Correct. I think you guys had this as a topic. I mean, every kid is different. There can't be one rule for every movie for every kid. And you know, my daughter, when she was like 3, she could handle Wizard of Oz.
Wow.
Which, you know, literally flying monkeys and stuff.
Into my teens, I think I was terrified by the flying monkeys. Those faces just freaked me out.
She could totally handle that. It was very early on that she could handle something like A Nightmare Before Christmas and stuff like that. So we've taken a very deliberate approach about like movies with her. Now she's 11, and PG-13 movies are pretty much, you know, the floodgates have been opened, and we do watch, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we, with new movies, we always make sure to watch the movie with the kid.
Yes.
My
only note on that is that the only one that makes me go, ugh, is watching a movie for the first time with your kid if you haven't seen it. And I'm not saying that makes you a bad person, but like there's a lot of stuff that I assume is fine in my head, given what she's seen. I mean, if she's made it through the last Harry Potter movie, I mean, there's some pretty dark stuff in the last half of that series. But then you forget like how much goes on. There's so much sex stuff and so much just really, really bad sexy stuff. And cursing you can mostly live with, but like there will be some sudden, extremely inappropriate things in even a PG movie, and you forget about it until you see it, and you're like, why is Dan Aykroyd getting a beach? Like, why is this happening?
Particularly like that mid 80s PG movie where
boobies.
You're like,
it had to be boobies in
what
every movie.
The hell is what's it? Ferris Bueller, and I'm gonna get this wrong. Is that PG or PG-13 or something?
I bet
1986.
It's
1986. There's a lot of risque stuff in there. And we were watching that with the kid, and she was, you know, I also think, especially if you're there and you're watching a movie, it's going to be I do have a couple basic rules about this stuff.
PG-13.
Okay. If you're going to be watching something new, be with them. And also, if there's even the remote chance of it being scary or intense, watching it in the daytime without a giant stereo system blasting with the subwoofer and everything. I think that makes a lot of difference. We've done some like A/B comparisons with our little one who's six. We're watching like Star Trek Next Generation episodes or something, you know, much more mild. And he'll get a little scared at some of the Star Trek Next Generation stuff.
I think grown-ups overlook the sound part. The sound part. My daughter has watched people be mowed down, as I told you, in Die Hard three different times. But when the dust storm, when we had the Sonos hooked up with the satellites, the dust storm started in Interstellar and she started crying and covering her ears. Just the dust storm scene. There's nothing happening in that scene. It's dust.
Christopher Nolan's audio makes a lot of people sad.
It's like that great scene in Interstellar when Matthew McConaughey is saying, Hans Zimmer is screaming in your ear.
We started watching that. My wife was like, she's looking at her iPad. We're watching Interstellar. I'm getting more into it than I have in the past because I've decided I'm going to get into this movie. And like, she's just sitting there on an iPad. Every few minutes, she's like, God, I hate him.
Christopher Nolan.
No. Well, that's the thing. You know, I'm in the middle of a big rehabilitation project with my wife because we differ. The movie we differ most over that I still find completely baffling, so much that I think she's wrong about what movie she saw, she still insists that she hated The Prestige. And I say, are you sure it's not the other magician movie with the guy from Fight Club? And she's like, I saw Prestige in this theater and it was terrible. I said, The Prestige is not terrible. It's one of his best movies, and there's no way.
What is the other one? The Illusionist? What is
I think that? So. Yeah. Edward Norton.
And I get them Jessica confused Biel. Too. Yeah.
The Prestige is a very good movie. It's got David Bowie as Elon Musk in that.
He played Elon Musk.
Yeah,
he did. Damn it.
I'm going to take it private. but no, anyway, I've run into this with a lot of folks where their kids can see things that, I mean, I've talked about this a million times. You've heard me say this a million times. We try to keep away from the sexy stuff. We try to keep away from personal violence. We very much try to keep away from rape or the threat of rape. Any of that kind of stuff is right out. And so like anything where like a knife is held to a child's, you know, throat is not something we're going to watch. We can watch stormtroopers get no scoped all day long and it's no big deal. But what about your kids, John? Are they sensitive to sound stuff? Like noises, like you go to a movie and it's loud. Does that freak your kids out?
I mean, when Todd was saying like, don't do it with the big sound system, my immediate thought was like, then that means it's not time to see it. Because if my kids aren't ready to see it, like the full experience, they're not ready to see it. Then I don't want to show them like a movie. The part of the experience of the movie is the shock and drama of the audio visual experience, but then tone it down. Like I want them to see it full. Right.
Right.
And most of the time I can tell what they're going to be okay with. Sometimes
I would add an asterisk, and if it's something that you're iffy about, there with our 11-year-old, there hasn't been anything where we've turned off the sound, but with the subwoofer and everything, but for the 6-year-old, we definitely are a little more careful about it. And when we, you know, like Kubo, for example, which I really loved, but it's got creepy music and it has sustained action, thunderstorms and stuff like that. He saw that in the theater and he did not have a very good reaction. He likes the movie. We know not to watch that with the subwoofer on and everything.
Mostly you just got to remember not to just watch the TV, but also watch the kid. A couple of movies, my son has bailed out of early just based on you look at him. You're like, okay, all right, we're going to basically just say, do you want me to turn this off? And he says, yes. And like, that's it. And we'll revisit that movie in a few years.
Whenever we watch Sharp Objects with our daughter, we like to keep an eye on her.
Oh, God. God, exactly.
She's that's because she's sad. Yeah. How do you feel about that? Should we talk about what that means? There's some scary music in this. A lot of Led Zeppelin.
Cut's already there. She's just letting it out.
Save
I'm
it.
Only on episode one. So.
Oh, sorry. No, no spoilers.
Yeah, no, that's all right.
Spoiler free. What do you think so far?
Oh my gosh, I know, love right? It is fantastic. I love how they're weaving in the construction of the in-universe flashbacks.
Okay, let's talk about that without spoilers, because I think John and I might differ on this. I haven't gotten up to date with John on this, but one thing this director does, I've never seen his Nicole Kidman show with The Little Lies, but apparently he did it on that show. But one of the things I love is that you really got to watch, because there will be a flash for what I would describe as a few frames of something. And you're not sure, is this something that she's seeing? Is this something that she is hallucinating? Is this a flashback? Like, what is it? Well, where do you stand on that right now, John? Are you still on the bubble with this show?
No, I like the show. It's just that this specific technique, and I don't want to spoil it because Todd has only seen an episode, but you see enough of it in the episode. Mm-hmm. My main issue with the technique, it's a combination of the media that was made and the environment in which it was made. So the environment in which it's made and viewed these days, we all have the power to pause and go back. Like, we, you know, whether you're watching it on like an iPad or on a DVR, for the most part, I don't think people are watching it on like broadcast TV with no way to go back. But all of us here, we have a way to go back, because that's just the way we consume media.
I watch every one of them. I watch every one of those flashes at least 3 times.
Right. And when you do something like that, like, my question is, when I'm watching it as a modern viewer, I'm thinking, is what you put on the screen to the point that Todd talks about in a lot of his VFX breakdown, is that supposed to read to me? Like, am I supposed to be able to tell what that was and who it was? Or did you intentionally make it go by so quick that it's not supposed to read, and that later you will bring me along by showing me the same clip more? Like, is this the beginning of a slow reveal that 3 mm-hmm. episodes from now you're finally going to reveal what happened, and I'm just supposed to get kind of the flavor? Or was I actually supposed to catch who that was? And a lot of the time, I don't know. And I find it frustrating because I can go back and pause and see it and figure out what it is. But then I think, this isn't how they expected you to view it, right? And so when they're super quick, you know they're not supposed to read, right? And when they're slow, you know they are supposed to read. I don't know if I'm using the right term here, but like...
Like, you're supposed to register what happened in that.
Yeah. Is there information in this flash that is supposed to be conveyed to me beyond the vague feeling that it gives me? And very often the flashes they do are in between, where they're not so short that it's clear to me that they weren't supposed to, you know, convey information, but they're not long enough for me to actually catch it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to have to go back and pause. Like, that's not how I want to consume this program for the most part. Maybe on a second viewing or something, or like when, like with Westworld, like after the season is over, you can go back and get more out of the stuff, because Westworld, it's clear, like, they're on the screen for a long time, but it's clear you don't have enough information yet to understand what you've seen, and eventually you will. But with the flashes, I can never decide whether they're trying to just give me a feeling or convey information. And I feel like they should push the flashes out to the edges, make it clear when it's just about a feeling, and make it clear when I was expected to recognize who that person was.
And, you know, not knowing how this all works out with the show.
It's all fine. Everything turns out fine. Nothing bad happens. Defending the show either.
I read it as a feeling, like, this person, the Amy Adams character, is, you know, back in her hometown, and she's obviously just surrounded with the trauma of her past. Mm-hmm. And the things that you see are the things that she's carrying with her, the pain, the memories, and sometimes they're just fragments, and sometimes they're, you know, very distinct and clear, and it's stuff that she's trying to bury or run away from or whatever. So this doesn't seem like a puzzle type show to me, like a whodunit or, you know, like a Lost or something like that, where did you see the clue? Did you see the logo mm-hmm. on the back of the door? That doesn't seem like this kind of show to me. So I admire this and other types of shows like this, because it's a, you know, it's a sit up straight and watch the screen type of show. You're not going to have this on in the background, or you're not going to be just I'll have it on while I fold laundry or something like that.
Those people, you go over their house and the television is constantly on. It's just got like, you know, the local news on in the background. If you go over someone's house and they have sharp objects on just constantly in the background, I'd really start smoothing. To worry.
Oh. Wait a minute. Who's he? Shut up.
Who's that guy?
I make my wife, I'm such a martinette about this one show. I'm like, we're going to sit down, we're going to put on our glasses, we're going to put away our devices, and I'm going to tell you every time a word appears and you miss it. I'm the worst.
How much time does she spend, instead of watching the show, looking at you with kind of a weird expression? Why are you making me watch this?
Did you notice there's lots of really interesting advertisements on the walls? Yeah, that's mm-hmm. kind of interesting, isn't it? Huh?
Yeah, the words change sometimes.
You notice they change. Are you guys familiar with the... I think it's 1972. You're familiar with the movie The Exorcist?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you remember Father Karras's dream sequence?
His mother's
walking out of a subway. There's a religious...
Damien. Yeah. And the subway is going.
And then there's this, like, you see the intercut with, like, a necklace, like, falling, like a pendant. And there's a... do you remember the little flash?
Of course.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember that, John?
I do not.
They flash... okay, you're the pro here, Todd. How many frames? What, three? Maybe three frames?
Probably two, and then I think it was more of a strobey thing, so it was on for two, and then maybe off, and then back on again.
Fair to say, if you could blink and miss it.
Oh, absolutely.
But there is, if you go, as I did with my VHS copy of this in college, super high, I did step through and pause on it, and every single person in my dorm room screamed as one. It's a real creepy demon face, like somebody, you know, like demonish makeup, really darkly shot. And it's been described by some people, I think incorrectly, as being a subliminal shot you know, that basically sort of like you're saying, John, is this supposed to register as something that's part of the narrative, or does this just achieve an effect? But that to me, I mean, had people ever done that before, Todd? Because you go back and watch that. I mean, there's some of the effects in that movie, maybe they seem silly. I still think that movie's terrifying. A little campy at points now, but like, I feel like that's such an effective thing. And I don't remember ever seeing it. Maybe The Graduate. It's done a little bit in The Graduate where you see a little flash and nipple, but you wouldn't normally see that kind of like that short of a shot. Would you maybe in a new wave movies would do that.
Yeah. Where they would do experimental editing and, you know, just little flashes, but then, you know, playing with montage has, you know, been a cornerstone of cinema. Once we had the capability to actually do a cut, everybody was trying to play with what you can do with that cut. The very, very first thing that comes to mind is that the second to last shot of Psycho, which is 1963 or something, of Norman Bates
before the in the long cell. Shot of, before that Kubrick shot of his face.
Yeah, yeah, I think, oh, very nice. Stop impressing me, Marlon.
And the way that thing is lit, that last shot looks impossibly modern. That does not look old. It's chilling way to end a movie.
Where they are cross-dissolving from a creepy Norman Bates staring right into the camera, which, you know, nobody was doing at that point, you know, and throughout the course of that film. So it's deeply unsettling, especially everything you've gone through. And they are about to cross-dissolve to the car that they're pulling out of the swamp, the very last shot of the movie.
Right.
But just before the cross-dissolve, you see a glimpse of his mother's withered corpse,
right,
superimposed on his face.
Oh,
and it's one of those where did I just see that kind of thing? And that's not a cut, that's not a strobe light or anything, but it's I don't know, it's subliminal, whatever. It's just supposed to put you on edge. It's supposed to unsettle you. And I don't know, that's my reference.
Oh god,
for stuff like that.
Oh god. Oh, you can't unsee this.
Are you looking at it right now?
This is really upsetting. Oh, there you go. Have fun. Sweet dreams.
It's your dessert. It's a reward that you get after hearing the psychiatrist explain and over-explain and over-explain the whole movie, the previous scene in Psycho.
Uh-huh. Oh, no.
Good movie.
That's a pretty good movie. That was a disruptive movie. It was unusual to kill your star on the first reel.
Yeah. I mean, it's no prestige, but...
And then the executive order did it. 50 years later.
It's good. I love that. You know, the TV shows that do it. Again, you know, I don't know if this relates to our non-topic, but, you know, the more media attention you have over something like The Shield. I mean, spoiler alert for The Shield, where the top billed actor, I think it was in a top billed or second billed actor, dies in the pilot. And it's supposed to be unsettling, and it's supposed to screw you up. And, you know, that's, I don't, could we get away with that today when people are like leaving a show that we know about it a year ahead of time? So we're all waiting for the episode of them to die when you hear in the, you know, it's reported in mass media when an actor is leaving The Walking Dead. And you're just like, well, I guess they're going to be dying in 3, episodes or so.
That would actually be a good, would you be into talking about that, John?
Mm-hmm.
This is a topic that we have been saving and growing like a hothouse flower for months now. A topic that started, we decided to save it for a very special episode with our very special friend, Todd. How did it start, John? It started with what I called, you know what it was? It was going to be our follow-up on what we had previously called spoiler culture. And it was meant to be me loaded for bear to talk about how there's got to be some more sane way to deal with what is called spoilers, right? It was going to be like, I've had it. Like, where is it okay to talk about anything anymore, right? That's how it was going to start. And then I feel like I added a little bit of meat to the bone just talking about, I feel like it's part of, so we ended up calling this topic the information problem, because my thesis is that it goes beyond spoilers. It's much more complex than that. Because obviously, you know, an example of that would be, for example, Sharp Objects. I have not read the book, but I've seen every episode of the show day and date. And I desperately, desperately want to talk about what's happening on this show with somebody. But on the other hand, and, you know, and haha, maybe I want to make little jokes online, but I do not at all want to be spoiled from people who have read the book, right? So I'm in this weird position of, on the one hand, being incredibly ravenous for exactly the kind of information that I want at the time I want it, and being utterly repelled by the idea of information I don't want when I don't want it.
It's kind of like a Game of Thrones situation where, you know, you got a very hit show, and but a lot of people know what's going to happen, and they just are hopefully being polite and sitting back and letting people enjoy things without, you know, giving them the big spoiler.
That's why it was a relief when the HBO show got ahead of the books. Like, oh, fine, we're finally safer than we were before.
Yeah, and maybe John wants to put a little bit of sauce on the taco at this point, but I this led to two threads. Well, one, we very much wanted you to include you on. You are widely credited as being the creator of the Full Media Blackout, also known as FMB. Which I'd love to talk about in this context, how you came up with that, how that works when you do and don't deploy. We actually had an episode where we talked about this once before. But then on the other hand, there's also what I call this context demand culture, where like, sometimes you're making a joke or a remark that's not for everyone. Sometimes you're mentioning something that's for certain people. And you look at the kind of rage responses that you get from people if they don't understand the context for what you're talking about. They don't understand that this was actually a joke about a joke about an in-joke. And now you're kind of obligated to explain that or expected to explain that. There's a lot of different handles to this suitcase. We can go any direction with it. But definitely want to cover FMB and want to get your thoughts on spoilers and information problem just in general.
I will have an opening statement on this, because you were talking about, you know, when I talk about Full Media Blackout, I mean, I'm talking about generally movies that you know you're going to want to see, so you don't want to know, you know, you don't want to hear casting information, you don't want to know what locations they're filming in, you definitely don't want to know any story points, because at least for me, my imagination will absolutely get the best of me. If there's a filmmaker, if there's a property, usually a sequel kind of situation where there's a framework of previously filmed material. Once I start to know things, my brain just keeps, you know, goes, hey, hog wild. I don't want to have anything attached to any of my imagination, because my imagination is already going crazy as it is. So don't give me any information, because when I want to sit down and see that movie for the first time, I don't want to be thinking of that cool money shot that was in the trailer, or why that, you know, I remember even as a kid seeing movies and like, I love that money shot in the trailer. And I'm just kind of, there's a little bit of a stopwatch going on in my head when I'm sitting in the movie theater. And like, when's that scene going to happen?
If you saw the trailer for Thor Ragnarok, there's a scene where he fights another Marvel character where it's a centerpiece of the trailer. But if you had gone into that movie not knowing that Thor was going to be fighting that particular character, it would have taken an already incredibly good movie and put it on another level. We're like, oh, that. Like, oh, and you learn, like, oh, Harvey Keitel has been cast in this thing. And you're like, well, great. Now I'm already coming up in my head with what that means that for that role and the relationships.
And I don't know. But that's the movie thing. Going in fresh, I think, is the best way to see the movie, because a lot of, especially, you know, from nostalgic reasons, a lot of the great movie experiences that we've had are usually when we were growing up and we didn't know. Somebody just sat us down and we just saw this movie that we'd never heard of before. Or you went to a theater and you didn't know anything about that movie. And you're just
flipping
like,
around on HBO after you're supposed to be in bed and you discover a movie you didn't know existed.
That was me, my first exposure to John Carpenter's Halloween.
For me, it was Escape from New York.
Yeah, it was on PBS, local. I don't know why they were showing Halloween, probably uncut at 10 at night. And that was my first experience. I'm like, what is this movie? What is this music? So anyway, that's movies. Now, TV shows, you have that issue of episodic TV shows of, you know, it's a water cooler show. The show was on last night. And then before DVRs and VHS, you had your one shot to watch it. And then the next day at work, you talk about it, whatever. With VCRs and DVRs, you have a little bit more respect. You know, you give it a couple days. You kind of, you give people the eye. Did you watch Game of Thrones last night? Or yay, nay. So there's an etiquette to that. And now with the Netflix model of just dumping the entire season at once. I mean, we're talking, you know, when you want to talk about a show with somebody else, that just adds a great deal of complexity. Like, when are you going to watch? When are you going to be able to talk about Stranger Things? When are you going to be able to talk about Glow or whatever? You know, somebody, you know, how people watch the entire season over the course of 2 days. Not me, people, but, you know, that changes the discourse even more if, like, you want to do an in-joke on Twitter or something. So I have no easy answers to this. There was a very funny Funny or Die, College Humor, one of those, particularly for TV, about the acceptable amount of time to be talking about spoilers for TV shows. I should probably get that for you for the show notes, which I thought was really funny, you know. The things that you can't spoil, like the episode, you give it like a week. For a season finale, you give it like a month. And then for
it's like
series finale.
It's like how long you wait for a professor based on their tenure. You know, if somebody's late.
Exactly. So with the dumping of the seasons, it's even more complicated, at least with something like the classic HBO series. Pretty much that night, everybody's going to be, you know, the vast majority of people who care about that show are going to see it then. And then the discourse can kind of begin.
I feel like the dumping of the seasons actually has helped. That model has helped me avoid spoilers, because when the old model where you air an episode at a time, if you don't happen to see Game of Thrones the night it comes out, like, you just can't look at anything. If all your friends are watching it, you mm-hmm. know they're going to be talking about it, and you're not going to tell them not to talk about it, so you have to avoid mm-hmm. it. But with the dumping of the whole season, there's this kind of understood agreement and caution where you have no idea when anyone has seen any episode. So unlike with Game of Thrones, when you know the most enthusiastic people have just seen it, and then now's the time to talk, nobody knows when to talk about the whole season dump. So mm-hmm. no one says anything until you've done the dance you're just talking about, where you're like, mm-hmm. have you seen all of season two of whatever? And once you confirm, then you can talk about everything at once. But you're not there. No one knows, like, today's the day where we're all going to talk about season three, episode five. There is no time like that. So I kind of like that. And I guess I also like it because I tend to watch those shows, not all in 1 or 2 days, but mm-hmm. I watch them faster than most people do. So mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about getting spoiled for the most part. And I end up watching it all. And then I can go find out like-minded people and just say, have you watched it? And they say yes, and then we can talk about the whole thing instead of an episode at a time. I find that much less stressful than, mm-hmm. you know, than Game of Thrones or Sharp Objects or any other thing that's like running now that I can't get ahead of time, because it's like, you just like have to avoid the entire internet and all of your friends. And like, you don't want to be, I think this is part of the information problem. Part of what annoys Merlin, I imagine, is you don't want to be that person who is just like walking down the street and then starts hearing something like Game of Thrones and sticks your fingers in your ears and goes, mm-hmm. la, 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 I'm not listening, la, 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 like, and kind of gives people the stink eye, or just like, you don't want to know, but it's not really socially acceptable to do what it takes to not know. It's bad enough that I close my eyes and put my fingers in my ears and hum when Star Wars trailers come on in the movie theater. At least that's dark and no one can see me and everything's so loud they can't hear me humming.
But, thank you for your service.
Right, but like that's about
I embarrass my daughter so bad when I do that. When I'm on FMB, she hates it. I'm rocking back and forth and it's, like,
yeah, at least the movie theater is dark and loud, right? But you can't do that if your coworkers are doing it. And if you go to them and say, could you please not talk about it? First of all, depending on your coworker, they'd be like, oh, that, now it's my cue to spoil you even more, right? Like you say with Sharp Objects, it's almost better if you just don't know that I'm interested in that show, because that'll protect me from jerks more than letting anybody in the world know that I am interested, because then someone will come, oh, great, let me tell you what happens. Let me make a joke about a spoiler that's not a joke or actually is a spoiler, but you won't know.
It's totally not a spoiler. Don't worry about it. I'm just going to tell you this one thing. Oh, don't. Just don't say it.
Tell you what my wife did for Avengers Infinity War?
What? No.
I mean, I can't actually tell you the spoiler, but she knows I don't like spoilers. And but she saw the movie before I did. And I said, don't tell me any spoilers, but just tell me if you liked it or not. And I'm expecting her to give me a thumb up or a thumb down or like the verbal equivalent of thumb up or thumb down. She said, I liked it, but I didn't expect insert spoiler.
Oh, like, that's man.
Not if you liked it or not. I just said, don't spoil it. Like, and she's married to me. She knows, but it's just sometimes people just want to say something. And she just had this one thing about the movie that she wanted to say that she didn't expect, that she assumed I already knew, but I didn't already know. I'm not on full media backup for Avengers. I just mostly don't travel in those circles. So I just don't know. It's like, come on. It's like,
I don't want to get ahead to a potential other topic, but there's another thing, and this is part of what I would call the context demand culture, which is like, so have you guys seen the TV show Patriot? So that's a show that is, I think, actually fairly resistant to spoilers in the classic sense. But this is true, Todd, you and I have talked about this a lot. I've made a list of what I call like small movies, the kinds of movies where like, I love this movie so much, but I'm scared to even recommend it to you because there's something very slight about it where you need to go in with very minimal expectations. Like if you go into game night with the same utter lack of expectations I had, you might really, really enjoy it. But if you hear from 10 of your friends that it's really, really good, that's all, it's already really hard. It's a catch 22. But the reason I say context demand culture and people are like, well, what does that mean? So like, here's the thing. So what do? I want to share my enthusiasm for something without spoiling it. So I want to say something like what? You should really check out this show, Patriot. Trust me, it's really good. You sound like a like when you say something like that, you're like, no, really? You know, it's like people who are constantly giving you your occasional reminder. Thanks. Save the occasional reminder. I don't need it. But like, I want to say to somebody, or you want to say like, oh, Sharp Objects, like, this is really special. Check it out. Now someone says that to me. I go, well, what the hell does that mean? What do you mean this is really special? Tell me why.
You're selling me on it. What's special about it?
Tell me what's special about it, because it's time for context demand now. Well, you've entered my world with the suggestion. Now you have to tell me why. And you say, well, you know, it's just there's the style is very unusual and the lead in it is great. I mean, I'm not saying this is the biggest problem in the world, but this is where you get into weighing how you do this. There's some kinds of things I'm very reluctant to. And one reason with Sharp Objects is like it's a very upsetting show.
Yeah.
If I tell you why it's upsetting, I mean I've already locked myself into an increasingly small series of cars. Like, okay, well, if you have certain kinds of issues, this is probably something you want to avoid. So do I say I recommend this for everybody? No. Well, why don't you recommend it for everybody? Oh, and I'm honestly, as Max says, asking the question. I don't know how to get out of this to be able to share my enthusiasm without becoming a pill.
It's kind of a losing proposition because you've just described in so many words, like the fall Oscar season backlash, where one's a lot of awards at film festivals when it gets nominated for a bunch of Oscars and Golden Globes. It builds a life. There's a life of its own. And then what those movies are, what is the purpose of film festivals and critics and award shows is to expose people to movies. They may, you know, to expose people to new movies and all sorts of different kind of movies. So when these movies get a lot of nominations, it's a whisper of somebody saying, you know what, you might want to check out this movie. But that 75 whispers becomes a roar. And then expectations are blown out of the water. So people see, how many times you've told somebody to go see a movie, this is after the Oscar nominations come out.
Look at Get Out. Imagine the difference between going in going into Get Out because you just kind of picked something off the marquee versus the impossible weight of expectations because of the way that that was lauded and discussed. It's not a small movie in my usual conventional sense, but that's too much to put on that little movie. It's a very special movie and it's really, really great. But like, if you went into that, like expecting this to be something that's going to paradigmatically change the way you think about race in America, that's a lot to ask of a movie.
I get frustrated when there's a perfectly fine, wonderful, small movie that doesn't necessarily have a great profundity, but gets a lot of Academy Award nominations and maybe even wins a couple awards. And then people see it after that giant wave of hype. Mm-hmm. And
it wasn't that good.
I mean, it was good, but
that was me.
It was totally overrated, man.
We're not going to release this episode, but that was me in the Netflix special, was called Nanette, where I had heard from so many people how funny and very, very important that was. And I watched it and I was like, that was good. It was like basically a good long TED talk. It was good. It was funny. I mean, it wasn't super funny, but like, first of all, how could I possibly, with those expectations, I go in? And then on the other end, I came out and I thought it was good, but like now I'm problematic because I didn't like it enough. And now I'm not a woke Twitter ally anymore because I thought it was basically a TED talk.
Yeah, you turned in your card, right?
I know. I'm no longer woke nor Twitter nor ally.
I've heard so much about that I don't think I'm ever going to watch it now. Because like
well,
I just
should.
Been,
it's very
just
important. Been, it's very important that our
I've just been too
this.
Turned off, and not because I. You know me in comedy, but it's like if that many people talk about it, it's like I just don't. It saps my enthusiasm for wanting to see it because I don't feel like I'm going to be able to extract the value from it. Like you said, of discovering something. If I discovered it on my own, I feel like they would have enough additional value.
There's
I don't
a lot
know,
of kids' movies like that. You take a movie like A Little Princess or something like that, where it is merely a gorgeous and very well done movie. But did you ever see that one? I forget the director's name, but it's that beautiful movie about the girls.
Alfonso Cuarón movie, yeah.
That's Cuarón?
Yeah.
You're kidding me. I love that
little
guy.
Little girl, A Little Princess.
That's Cuarón? No wonder I love it.
Yeah.
I love that movie, but if I over-recommended that movie to somebody, they're going to be like, what? It's like Sad Madeline. Like, well, why is this a big deal? Because you crush the delicacy of that particular blossom under the weight of all those expectations. Did I ever talk you into Blue Ruin? Did I ever talk you into that?
No.
It's that guy. It's the guy from Green Room.
Yeah, I was just about to say Green Room. Another one of those where hopefully nobody has ever heard of it, and you tell them, go see this movie.
Yeah, why?
I'm not watching Green Room because the little I know about it makes me think it's not a movie I like. Like, that's my strategy. Like, getting back to what Merlin was saying before about, oh, you should watch this. I think, it's really special. Why? What's special about it? Or you shouldn't watch this if you like it. Where they demand more information, or you've teased enough of it that they want to know more. Mm-hmm. To know what it is you're talking about. My solution for that, for things that I actually do want to recommend that I think works okay on me, but it's very difficult to do well, is to say, if you liked X, you might like Y. Basically, it'll become a human mm-hmm. recommendation engine, right? Mm-hmm. And it's tricky because if you do this, if you say, if you like The Sixth Sense, you might like insert movie X.
Right.
That immediately makes people, aha.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so
one thing
now
I know about
the
Sixth Sense is that it's got a twist. So I bet this movie they've recommended got a twist, and now you basically spoil part of it because I'm going in and waiting for the twist. So I can't. That's a bad example, but you can do it well. And The Patriot and The Leftovers, I think, are two great examples because they're so different. There's never mm-hmm. going to be a show exactly like The Patriot or exactly like The Leftovers, mm-hmm. but they're weird enough to say, if you like weird shows that are weird in this way, you might also like this show that is weird in a different way, but you've mm-hmm. shown that you like weird shows. So I think this thing might appeal to you. And there's nothing that's going to be spoiled. Like if I say, if you like The Patriot, you might like Killing Eve. The mm-hmm. shows are not similar at all, except
that's a terrific example.
Except that both of them are different enough from standard TV fare that if you liked one of them, it shows you're open to different kind of shows and you're not going to be like, this is too unconventional and I'm not able to follow it in the normal way that I am. Like if that's not your reaction to The Patriot, then maybe you like Killing Eve, right? And it doesn't reveal anything about either show. And I found that's the best way to, for my tweeting experience, to have people come to me later and say, hey, you said if I liked X, I like Y. Well, guess what? I did like X and I watched Y and it was great and you were totally right. And mm-hmm. I don't get people angrily saying, Well, why? What should I see? Or you spoiled it or whatever. So that's.
But you got a double turns out there, which is if you say to somebody, oh, if you like stuff like, I don't know, if you like stuff like The Crying Game, The Empire Strikes Back, and Sixth Sense.
Right.
And Psycho. If you like movies like that, and you're like, wait, and your shape sort of starts going, oh, it's all things with an almost completely unexpected twist. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you say that's a ruiner. Okay, so what do you do instead of that? You say, oh, listen, here's the thing. You should check out this movie.
Don't read anything about it. That's just as bad.
It's just as bad. It's just
it
as
is.
Bad.
It is.
But also, if your shape sorter ends up coming up with, oh, now this person likes weird movies. They like Killing Eve or weird TV shows. They like Killing Eve. They like these off kilter. You know, oh, maybe you like even something like It's Always Sunny. So you say what? So you suggest like Twin Peaks.
Well, let's see. I wouldn't to give an example. I would say if you like The Patriot, it doesn't mean that you'll like Sharp Objects, even though both of them are unconventional, because they're unconventional in different enough ways mm-hmm, that I feel mm-hmm. like it's, you know, because Sharp Objects is difficult. Sharp Objects is the only closest one I can find, I think I mentioned this to you already, is season one of True Detective, which is also an upsetting mm-hmm. crime mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sharp Objects is even more upsetting, I feel like.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's ruining anything, because if you know, by the first 2 minutes of Sharp Objects, you know.
I feel bad that I just ruined The Empire Strikes Back for somebody, because they know there might be a twist.
No, they're fine.
But I just want to say, part of the whole recommendation engine aspect of it is yourself, because you don't want to get that frustration come back at you. And at a certain point, I've kind of lost interest in hearing complaints afterwards. I'll take all the accolades. If they like something, you know, thanks for introducing me to that. That's all great. If you didn't like it, you know what? Move on to the next piece of art. I mean, you're not going to like every painting in the museum. It's okay to take chances on stuff. And I would rather you take a chance on a movie or a TV show that is a little bit outside the norm, that is a little bit different, that might be just trying to do something a little bit differently than your typical network stuff or your typical blockbuster stuff. If you didn't like it, so what? You move on to the next thing. I mean, not liking stuff having, you know, pieces of art that don't connect with you is
not being aligned with your tribe's reaction to this is maybe another way of putting it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's where Letterboxd really helps there. My second technique is rather than getting recommendations from people or having, trusted friends tell me based on what they know of what I like, what I might like, or whatever. Letterboxd lets me stalk people, where you can follow them, and if they dutifully log what they watch, and especially if they dutifully log what they watch and maybe give it a star rating, mm-hmm. that's where I get most of my movies from. I just watch what the people who I follow watch, and I pull from the movies they're watching into my watch list. Sometimes I look at their ratings, but most of the times I don't. I just say, these two people I know both decided to watch this movie.
Mm.
That probably means that I might like it, and I'll go and I'll try it. Say I end up hating the movie. There's no interaction where I feel like I have to go back to them and say, hey, you recommended this movie to me and it was crappy, so your recommendations are bad. They didn't recommend it. All they did was watch it and log it, mm-hmm. and I stalk them. Like, I'm watching what they watch.
There's no obligation either way.
Right, and I feel like that's really comfortable. First of all, I've discovered some great movies that way that I never heard of. I never even heard these movies exist, and I pulled them out of this. I'm like, what the hell is that? And, you know, I'll just, based on the cover image or like, you know, whoever, I see enough people watching that I try it. And second, there's no obligation either way. It's one of the best sort of, you know, you hear about this with music discovery, like how do you find new music? I've really been enjoying Letterboxd as a way to find new movies that I will like merely by doing the Twitter model. Like, you decide who to follow and that's it. And we don't tweet to each other. We don't, you know, talk.
John, how are you pronouncing it? Letterboxd?
Yeah. Letterboxd, okay. They call it like as in past tense. There's no E.
I don't know. We never talk about that out loud.
In Unix parlance, when you have Unix demons, they end with D because it means it's the demon thing, right? And
like
there's the same
D.
sort of GIF pronunciation thing. Some people in the Unix world say whatever D, and some people try to pronounce it as if it had ED at the ending. So
Merlin, you're on Letterboxd.
Am I?
But you're on it, but you're not active, right?
No, I don't think I am. Oh. I'm not.
And I log the new movies that I've seen, and I think I've been doing it for like.
Said.
I think I've been doing it for like 5 or 6 years.
I give 5 stars to everything. I don't have any sense.
Yeah, I log and rate everything, but I don't really review anything.
Oh yeah, I don't think I've written a single review, but I think it's been the last 5 or 6 years, and I'm so glad I started doing that, because it's a diary, it's a log of the movies you've seen, and for me, it is, you know, talking about recommendations, it's the perfect thing when somebody goes, hey, what's a good movie, or you got any good comedies to recommend, or they just don't make good movies anymore, and I just want to go, let me bring this up, and I'm like, okay, I love this movie, I love this movie, I love this movie, you know, just try one of these movies. So glad I started doing that. I want to get my kid to maybe start logging her movies, but that sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, and to be useful, like, it would not be useful for me to say tonight I'm going to go in and put in 10 of my 5-star movies. Like, it would have to be something where, I don't know, can you hook it up
to
Plex?
No, just start. No, just whenever you watch a new movie, add it. And just see if it's pretty easy. It's pretty straightforward. A couple taps and you did it. But I don't know.
Big Lebowski.
The task of going back and doing your back catalog is a little bit too much to ask. But I would say, like, yeah, just do it going forward. But I like the idea of star rating them. Because it lets the person who's stalking you know, yeah, you watched it. But, you know,
we could do
thumbs up or thumbs down.
Half stars.
Took me a while to realize you could do half stars. And then I go back and I re-rate sometimes every once in a while if I rewatch something.
I try not
to
rebalance, but if you look at my ratings, I use the whole scale.
Mm-hmm. Use every part of the scale.
I give out very few fives ever.
Just for you two?
Uh-oh.
I sometimes think that for ratings to be useful again, for some reason, I'm thinking of Jason from The Good Place, where he talks about the rating system where it goes up to 6 and down to 10 like a tent. There was one rating system I heard about somewhere on a podcast where basically it was like rating from 1 to 6, something like that. But it was one of those things where it's like, I think God, help me out. Where did I hear about this? It was 1 to 6 and you can't pick 4. Was that it? But it's one of these systems that forces you. It's that exactly this kind of mind trick, and I'm probably saying it wrong, but I love the idea of a mind trick that gets me out of the paradigmatic style that's gotten me into this. Oh, it's a 5 or it's a 2. You know what I mean? Because then I get into facets. Like, I start thinking about facets, and now we start getting into, like, John, like you and I have talked about, like, what's the good? What's the best? You know, what's the best? What's your favorite? What's a good one to start with for TV shows? But you're saying just go in and just start giving, give a rating.
What helps you get over that, like people fretting about the rating, especially when they're giving the whole 5 stars with halves, right? Then just you get all inside your head about it. What gets you over that hump is just doing it a lot. Because then it just becomes like, I've done this so many times. I don't have time to think about. I just have to kind of go with my gut and that's it. And if you rate movie after movie after movie, because you probably do watch more movies than you think you do, you'll get out of that headspace where you're worried about, like, have I rebalanced this? Do I actually like this movie better than the one that's half star lower? Or have I given one of the wrong ratings? Like, resist the urge to go back and readjust. Just come up with a system and just do it going forward. Because really what you're trying to figure out is, how did I feel about the movie after I watched it? And at least for me, if I was following you, that gives me the most value, because I can, you know, I can kind of tell. Like, I don't care in retrospect at the end of the year decided it actually should be a 1.5 stars lower. All I care is after you watched it, when you logged it, how did you feel? Did you feel 3.5-ish, 4-ish? Did you feel 1 or 2-ish? You know, did you feel 5? Like, if you put it at 5, I'm not gonna say, oh, this, you think this is 5, but that was 4.5. I'm not gonna get all cranky about that. You just have to just do it. And the other good feature about this is that it lets you add a watch list, right? So again, when I see other people do things, I put them on my watch list. When I hear them talking on, like, NPR podcast about, you know, or recently, who was talking about this? Maybe it was you. Someone was talking about the Andre the Giant documentary.
I just saw you added that to your watch list.
Yeah.
And, I have concerns about your privacy.
Gilbert Gottfried one.
Okay.
I added them to my watch list, because otherwise I'm going to forget they exist, or I'm not going to get the title right or whatever. And also, film festival movies, like, oh, everyone's raving about blah, blah, blah movie. It's like, well, great. I can't see it anywhere unless I go to New York City. It's not going to come out in any form that I can purchase or view in any way for like a year and a half. I will totally forget that exists. Let me add it to my watch list.
Yep. For me, it was an adjustment with all this 5-star stuff, because I grew up with Roger Ebert, was my hometown, you know, movie reviewer, and he did, you know, thumbs up and thumbs down on TV. But for the Sun Times, he did star reviews, and he hated doing the stars, famously. But I got it, you know, my spectrum is 0 stars to 4 stars. And it's taken me forever to like kind of expand that out
you,
to 5.
You review like a programmer.
No. Like they used it. 4 used to be the max.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
4 was excellent.
You start counting at 0.
4 was an excellent movie. So.
Yeah. Same thing when I was growing up in the newspapers, but I'm okay with 5s because so few things get it. Oh, the final thing I do is movies that come out in theaters that I know I'm not going to see in theaters, but I want to remember exists on the watch list.
Hmm. Yeah.
Can anybody put their hand to Roger Ebert's credo about the success of a movie that I'm always quoting or misquoting?
It's not not what it's about, but how it's about it.
Is that it? That's kind of it in a nutshell.
I think so. Right.
I think it was in like kind of in the context of how dare you make you know give this comedy 3.5 stars,
yeah, this particular
this
comedy
drama,
yeah.
2.5 stars. Well, it achieved what it set out to achieve, and for what
that's a different saying.
Yes, that's a different. Yeah.
Both from Ebert, I believe.
That was the one I was thinking of, is that I'd say, I don't know, gosh, he's written so much great stuff, but it was something that I wish I could find it to get it right, but it was something along the lines of that he goes into each movie, I mean, this is my words, not his, but on its own terms, and like you say, like, did this movie succeed at what it seemed to be trying to do? And that's, to me, that's part of the beauty of the FMB, that's part of the beauty of being 13 and up a little bit too late, watching, you know, Escape from New York, going in absolutely zero cold, except from what, maybe you've seen an ad in the paper, but you know, you don't know anything, like who's Snake Plissken? I have no idea. There's something that's so special about going in that particular way. And that's why I had a kind of an awkward question for you, Todd, that we can cut out. But like, you know, this is, you work in a racket where you are producing, you're involved in helping to produce some of the most widely watched and heavily scrutinized properties, full stop. Like you've got the full, and I feel free to just skip this one, but you've got the entire universe of people who love Star Wars for different reasons in their bones. And like the way they're going to feel about Han Solo might be a little bit out of whack with like how good or bad the movie actually is, because they've got their own private set of criteria about how it hewed to their own idea, really anything in the last few years. How do you feel about that responsibility, burden, or opportunity? Knowing that, does that freak you out? Knowing that people are scrutinizing it all in their own separate ways?
You know, it's something that I don't really internalize while we're working on the picture. It's more of just a fascination of after the movie is released and talking with people about what affected them, and it constantly makes me rethink like the decisions that we made on a sequence, or how did it affect people? Because you know, usually the big character stuff, like you know, Han Solo and The Force Awakens biting the dust, it's like the way that affected some people has less to do with filmmaking and more to do with memory, nostalgia, family, and what these properties mean to them, and the what these stories mean to them. So, I mean, if people are coming out of, you know, I'm one of those people where if people are coming out of a movie like upset and they just want to talk about it, they just want to talk about how mad they are about this thing, that this movie, like we one of my worst movie going experiences was introducing the David Fincher movie Seven to some friends of mine. Where this is like after it came out on home video, and I really didn't think it through, the type of person that I was going to sit this movie through. I don't know.
Oh, are you showing me this, Todd?
Yeah, because afterwards,
the last scene is very sunny. It's fine.
I don't like this beginning, man.
Our best friends were mortified that we would show them this movie. They were and this has happened in college. They were mortified that we would want to be in an industry that would make a movie like this, and that we like it so much that first. So you know, we talked about the movie for about 3 hours, and obviously there was something in there that affected them that worked. And yeah, it's not pleasant. And what, you know, separating the movie that, you know, you want to hang out with those characters, you know, separating that feeling with what is a really cool story and what's a cool way to tell it. You know, those are interesting things that I always love to examine in how people watch movies. So when it comes to the Star Wars stuff, it's, you know, I got to say, when we're making the movie, we're following the director's lead. And we all know, you know, I've been very lucky to work with a lot of really great directors who this is their vision. Hey guys, let's try to, I need ILM to help me fulfill this vision. And then there's always a back and forth. There's this collaboration. We offer up ideas. They offer up ideas. And while we're in it, we want to tell the best story for this movie. And it's different for every movie. It's, mm-hmm. it's not just plug and play and, oh, well, we did this on the last one. Let's just do this thing again. So when we're in it, it's just like, it's all about winning that battle and telling the story. And like, what's the smartest way to how much fat can we cut from this? How do we really need this shot? Where do we want our eyes to go? I'm not, you know, thinking about the eventual backlash about what's going to happen when, you know, the sequence is seen. I mean, it's something that is, that's part of the whole experience of making a movie and then releasing it. You never know how people are going to react. Mm-hmm. And I'm always surprised about what people are affected by. You know, yeah, there's definitely going to be sequences that's going to be a slam dunk and people are going to love it and this is going to be a big hit. But sometimes you just don't know. A quiet little moment. Like I remember on The Force Awakens, the early part of the film when it's a lot of Rey all by herself, you know, making herself her food and camping out.
I love that so much.
I thought that was all really lovely and beautiful while we were working on it. But then after people saw it and it realized how much it affected them, that was a real surprise to me. I was like, wow, this is really connecting with people.
I was scouring the internet to try and find the image of her with the helmet on, eating her disco bread. Like, oh my God, I thought that was very effective.
And people getting upset about, like, you know, plot points, like, I can't believe this character, this. It's not as if you and ILM have control over the major plot points of the movie. Like, you're not the writers. Right. So if you disagree,
well,
that
the writers do the good work. It's CGI that's ruining movies.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like,
we come in and wreck
actually,
it all.
You don't actually, to your point of executing the vision, like, you don't actually have control over the story. Right. So mm-hmm. it's not as if you really feel like this is a betrayal of everything this character stands for, they would never do this. You can't change that. Right. But I feel like there are still things that people can get annoyed about where they can lay some of the blame on how the shot was executed. To give an example from The Last Jedi, a lot of people had objections to the Mary Poppins sequence. And not so much about what happened, but exactly how it was executed. Because you could execute, like, the script says this happens, right? You can execute that lots of different ways. And the specific choices made by the visual effects artists affect how the audience perceives that. You know, by intentionally or unintentionally referencing something or bringing to mind something. And maybe when you're doing that shot, it's not in your head that it's going to trigger that. But all of a sudden, the shot goes out into the world and you realize a lot of people, when they see this thing happen, executed in this specific way, it triggers this memory that doesn't fit with what they expect out of the sequence. And it gives them, you know, it pulls them out of the movie briefly. And that's a thing where, I mean, first of all, you can't anticipate that because who knows what everyone's going to think about. And second, I can imagine when you're that close to it, again, you're not thinking about how will the most uncharitable mind pull itself out of this moment of the movie to think about something totally unrelated to what I'm doing based accidentally on how I choose to implement this shot or how the director, you know, says that you should implement it, because you never know what the give and take is there. So although you can't control what characters live and die and what they do, I feel like the execution details can surprisingly surface in the mind of the public in ways that, for me at least, would be unexpected.
Yeah. I mean, there's even with something as simple as what you might think is like a space battle, there's a lot of different ways to make a space battle. And that's something that we're always tweaking things to change the mood or the feel or the intensity or how this all is, you know, we want you to interpret this stuff. There's all, and that's something that I love. That's probably my favorite part of the job is trying to come up with the feel of the sequence and what is it that we're actually trying to accomplish. Yes, Carr, you know, does a spin around and, you know, does a jump and the crash and the hero jumps out and he's barely made it in time. But what are the beats? What are the moments? What are the rises and falls? That's the stuff that fascinates me the most and the stuff that we do have an impact on. But you know, hey, and you add to the complication of the fact that these are not just highly anticipated movies by really cool directors. These are people's characters. They're theirs. They're part of their family. Mm-hmm. And people, especially nowadays, there's an attitude of well, how dare you do that to my family? And that's not how art works. We didn't come to your house and murder one of your family members. We're offering up you an opportunity to go to a movie theater with a bunch of people, sit in silence in a dark room, and we're going to tell you a story. Yes, this does involve some of your characters, and I don't know that. That the whole fan entitlement stuff is stuff that I can talk about a lot.
That's got to be rough.
It doesn't bother me.
Do people bitch as much about DC movies as they do about Star Wars properties? Because if there's anything are there that many people? There are a lot of people who don't like the DC movies for all the right reasons, in my aesthetic opinion. But like, are there people that are that upset about Superman in that case as they are about
definitely.
As much as Luke, as how Luke is portrayed.
Yes, for sure. Superman, that's probably the most anger I've seen about a film portrayal of.
Not that they're even comparable in terms of. I mean, I'm not trying to say that they're equivalent, but I mean equivalent in terms of like if you are very attached to that character, there may be reasons you see that either of those portrayals as being objectionable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the difference is that the Superman is. Mostly the foundation they have is either the comic books or like the movies from the 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because people didn't really mind like Superman Returns. They're like, well, I didn't like that movie, but no one was watching that and saying this is a betrayal of everything that Superman stands for, right?
Because everybody fell asleep.
Yeah, well, whatever. But I didn't mind it that much. But Man of Steel, you take this character that people have a very strong idea about and you subvert or change or do something about it. And then you continue that for, you know, the sequels and everything. And then basically people who are big Superman fans, a certain subset of them say, like, that's not my Superman. Like, they're disassociating. They're so angry. Whereas everything that Star Wars has done, like, no one is really saying that's not my Luke anymore. They're just saying, like, well, I would rather have done X, Y, or Z.
But I don't know.
It's not as big. Backlash I saw from Superman, Man of Steel, was way bigger than what I saw from, and that's just Superman. Batman, I think, is less. The Batman people like Batman shouldn't use guns, and he does. I feel like it's tamped down a little bit. But Superman, because it's like their pinnacle franchise character, and that's sort of emblematic of everything they've done to the DC. It's like once you ruin Superman, like, well, who cares? You just ruined everything at that point. Like, just fine.
One of the things that DC has going for them is that at every, you know, you could just like wait it out because in a decade, there's going to be, you know, a restart of the whole thing. You know, you look at Batman, you got the Tim Burton era that led into the Joel Schumacher era.
Mm.
You know, they're all, you know, okay, I guess those are two separate eras. Then you got the Christopher Nolan era. And now you've got the Zack Snyder-verse era. So just, you know, give it time. If you don't like the current Batman or Superman, just wait.
Yeah, I think Superman really hurt people because Superman was so iconic as like a very early superhero movie that was actually any good, right? And people remember it. And then there was a big gap. And then there was Superman Returns, which was like false start, right? And then another big gap. And then the DC one. And I think that the trailers to Man of Steel were very promising.
They were for a very different movie. That could have been a Christopher Nolan movie.
Yep, but the actual movie made some different. And that was, you know, that was the first inkling that things were going to go a little bit differently.
That's the first movie we ever had my daughter, first movie I ever left with my daughter. It's a real honor.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. We were partway into the first act, and I was like, oh, no. This is way too loud and bad. It was very different from the trailer. I don't know if you know this, Todd, but sometimes the way things are, how does one say, edited with the trailer or with the final product. You don't probably don't, I don't know if you come across this in your work, but sometimes stuff that's in the trailer may not be in what gets on the screen.
Hmm.
Sorry.
Yeah. Never really.
I'm a criticizer.
Oh, and getting back to the question, actually, I thought you were going to ask Todd, speaking of trailers and Todd knowing things.
Yeah.
Way back when you were asking about the Star Wars movies, you're asking about like, when you work in a movie that you know people are going to have strong reactions to. What I thought you were going to ask is a question I've actually asked Todd in the past, but I think it's good for him to give his answer again, because I think it's a very interesting problem. You already mentioned like you're working for the company that you wanted to work for when you were little. You always wanted to do visual effects, and you know, you're a Star Wars fan. You work on Star Wars movies now. It's like everything's coming up Milhouse, right? Mm-hmm. But what I always think about in this situation as an outside observer is like, and especially in light of your Full Media Blackout stuff, is you are signing up to never be able to get the pure experience of any Star Wars movie that you work on. You're essentially ruining Star
Wars. I was worried
that
was too on the nose, but yeah, are movies ruined for you now?
Well, just the Star Wars ones that he works on. And, you know, like, so how do you know, like, obviously it's awesome to work for ILM and to work on Star Wars movies. But as a Star Wars fan, any movie that you work on, you can't get the experience that you would ideally want out of that movie for viewing it.
Yeah. It is absolutely it's a sacrifice that I hadn't even like considered until like well into the first or one or two films of working on Star Wars. It is like, it is such an immeasurable privilege to be able to become an author of this stuff, that the, creating the future cinematic memories is such an incredible position to be in, that I don't even think about the fact that I cannot go into a Star Wars movie and enjoy it opening weekend.
You're like the giving tree, Todd.
Yes, it's
well. I mean, the fact that you're working on it is. I mean, it's a smaller case version of like, you know, can Paul McCartney enjoy Eleanor Rigby? Mm-hmm. Like, can the, you know, you hear a lot about like music artists, very famous music artists, have some beloved album or song that they themselves have either never enjoyed the way everyone else has or can't enjoy it the way everyone else has because it's too close to them.
Even though they're maybe making the genre of music that they're most attached to and they could potentially love that song more than anybody, even after the 3 days that they've spent recording it, by the time you're done, I can just say, by the time you're done recording a song for 3 days, you never want to hear it again.
And not that even just that you're sick of it, but that even if you're very pleased with it, you're too close to it to ever experience it in the way that everyone else does. And
it has more of a life in your head. So in some ways,
I typically spend up to a year working on these pictures too. So we've had, you know, opening weekend, if I go see the movie, I'm a complete wreck. I got butterflies in my stomach. Is this going to work? Or are people going to laugh at the right moments? There is no way I can enjoy this movie because all I see are the people's faces that made these movies, that made these shots, the arguments that we had, the design decisions that we had to make. Oh, this scene was so great, but we had to cut it. Or, oh, if we only did that one thing, my wife at the Rogue One cast and crew screening told me later, and I didn't realize this. She said, "You, Todd, the look on your face the whole time leading up to the movie and while we were watching it, you looked ashen. You looked absolutely dejected." And I was like, "Why? Oh, yeah. It's because I was reliving all those battles and thinking of all the things that I could have done better or something." So that was a particularly, it just meant that I was super vulnerable because I put a lot of myself in that movie. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we, you know, hoping would land and, you know, I wanted it all to work. I realized after that, I'm never going to make that mistake again of like, you know, putting all of my emotions on my sleeve, at a premiere. I mean, anything, if you spend a year on anything, you know, it's going to take you some time to be able to have any kind of distance. And for me, usually I cannot sit and watch a movie that I've worked on for at least 5 years until I can actually like look at it for what it is. Because it's all those battles are so fresh. I don't know. I mean, I believe so strongly in this stuff, and you know, I don't know. The amount of thought that I put into my sequences are, you know, it makes it difficult for me to, you know, go, okay, all right, let's just watch the movie. Yay, it's all happy and oh, that worked out really great. No, it's always churning, and I'm always thinking about it. So
the flip side of that, this was an example of where, you know, we get movies that you would love to watch normally, but now you're a part of making them, and you're taking that as the trade-offs well worth it. Like I much more value being able to be a part of making it. That way outweighs the ability to enjoy it, right? But the flip side is, what about a movie that you would never in a million years even consider watching? It's not your kind of movie, it's a bad movie, whatever, and yet you work on it, right? How do you feel when watching a movie that you just don't like? Either it's a bad movie, you don't like it, or both, but you worked on it. And maybe you're proud of your work on it, but you still think the movie's a stinker. How do you feel when you're watching that?
It's a conundrum. And here's the deal. Every single person in Hollywood, I mean, people can have 20-year careers in Hollywood, grips, camera operators, you know, prop makers. They could go their entire career and not work on a good movie. You know what I'm saying? And they could be really good at their craft.
Well, it's a job, right? I mean, you show up and do the work you need to do today.
It's a gig.
I mean, Joe Rosenstiel worked on Watchmen, which is a movie that I am in the minority of really, really liking. I think that's a very good movie for what it is and what it is meant to be. But like for the rest of your life, you walk around going, yeah, I worked on Watchmen. I was like, oh, it's not as good as the comic, right?
Yeah. I mean, and so, you know, I've been really fortunate to have worked on a lot of like good movies. Early in my career, when I was working on, you know, before ILM, you know, it was like, thank God I get to work on a Sylvester Stallone movie because there's a chance that somebody will have heard of it, you know, that kind of thing.
Like somebody you meet in an airport, you go, oh yeah, I worked on that arm wrestling movie. And they'd be like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly. No, it was his car racing movie, The Driven. Have you ever heard of it? Really?
Yeah.
Driven?
Yeah, I did that. You know, that scene with the car, that was me.
So it's not a problem. It is weird to spend it. Well, here's the deal. Spending a year of your life being intensely creative in any facet of filmmaking on something that pretty much everybody knows is going to be a piece of garbage. You just got to get into the right headspace. You just, you know, you got to be on time. You got to do your job. Don't complain. And then, you know, you're rolling the dice on the next project. Because if you get to work with really good people, you could have a really fantastic, fulfilling career working on garbage, you know, for your entire life. But you could be super fulfilling and you make really great friendships and you can actually push yourself creatively. For me personally, if that was indeed the case, I think I would have to have some kind of other creative outlet. To try to, you know, flex those kind of muscles. But like, I don't know. I've been, like I said, I've been super lucky to have worked on a lot of really good movies and definitely a lot of stinkers.
Do you find it's actually easier to do you cringe less when watching the stinkers? Because you're not worried about, I hope this movie works. Like you can just disassociate from the movies. Like, yeah, the movie's a stinker. But let me look at that one shot that I'm really proud of. And then you're not caught, like you were with Rogue One. You're like, oh, these fights that we had, and I was so passionate about it, and I wonder if this will work in the audience. On a stinker, you're like, this whole movie's not going to work for the audience. Yeah. So I'm even that worried about that. But I can sit back and enjoy the pure technical aspects of my one glorious shot in this otherwise stinker movie in a pure way that you can't for a movie that you care more about.
Yeah, I see your point. I mean, the pressure is definitely off, you know, in terms of the grand, the impact that's going to have, because we all know it. I mean, it is, you know, you wish that certain things didn't happen like this. Like you hear whispers and the trades or whatever. Oh, we started filming and we didn't even really have a script. And it's like, ah, that can't possibly happen. That's hyperbole. No, but that doesn't. Yeah, it happens. And it happens when every single person at the top hates the script or can't stand the lead actor or whatever. Or they know it's a bad match. But you know what? we're all going to do the best we can, and let's just tell the story and be really good at our jobs and just get, let's just move on and hope something bigger and better comes from it. And then when it comes time to see the movie, yeah, you can kind of sit back and kick your feet up and go, yeah, this is pretty cool. And I don't know if it was nothing but garbage, I don't know how I would react. In terms of like, is this really worth my time and my energy? And then, like I said, I think side projects would have to be.
As a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, is that the full name?
Yeah.
All right. As a member of that, so how do you feel about a situation where the winner or nominees for the visual effects category aren't good movies? Like, the effects are really good, and presumably, like, I don't know what the guidance is, like, that's what you're judging, right? Best visual effects. It's not best picture, it's not best director, it's not best screenplay, it's just best visual effects. How do you feel about a bad movie winning? Like, is that, like, because you're going to have to vote on it now, so you're going to have to make some decision, but even before you were a member, like, what was your take on that? It's like, if you saw the nominees and you're like, oh, that should definitely win because it has the best effects, I don't care, it was a garbage movie, or can you not bring yourself to say, like, that shouldn't win because great effects that aren't in service of an overall good movie, like, shouldn't win?
Yeah, like, this movie doesn't deserve to get an accolade. That's a problem I've never had to personally tackle with until now. I just, for context, in terms of the visual effects Academy Award nominees are actually determined by the visual effects branch. We as a branch come up with that list. It's a list of 15 films that get whittled down to 10, and then we have a bake off. Actually, we have a 10-minute clips of each movie get screened. With a little bit of Q&A and one big night. And we're the only branch that does it. And I think the makeup branch actually does that too, where you actually are all in the same room and you all watch the exact same stuff and get to hear the Q&As. And then we, as a visual effects group, determine which are the five nominees for that Oscar. And then the winner is the full Academy, that is determined by the full Academy. Yeah, I got to think, you know, I'm going to make a sports analogy, and I, you know, knowing my audience, maybe this isn't the best thing. I grew up as a Cubs fan, and there was a year that the Cubs were pretty much in last place, but we had a player named Andre Dawson who was absolutely amazing. He had a fantastic batting average. He hit a lot of home runs, ton of RBIs. And it was really controversial when he got the MVP for that year. You know, I'm going to have to check this afterwards, make sure I'm not just, it's not my nostalgia. I'm just going to say, for the purposes of this story, he got the MVP of the year for the National League on a last place team. That doesn't usually happen.
Right.
And what it means to me is that the award is, in that respect, given to the person who was most valuable to that team. For these movies with great visual effects that are maybe stinker movies, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about. Like, what was this movie trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. Was it a grotesque film that probably is bad for the world? Like, do I feel like this movie is bad for humanity? I don't know, that would cause a very, you know, important ethical question when it's time for me to vote. You know, if it's a stinker of a movie, but it, you know, that's the movie that had the best visual of, you know, people were talking about it, and how do they do that moments in it that really captured people's imagination? Part of me is like, that movie should win. And that crew, because it is a craft award, that movie should win. That said, the full Academy votes on the Academy Awards, not just...
And they're probably not going to be in that same headspace.
Right. So everybody's going to be bringing their own attitudes to that ballot. And there are a lot of people who are just saying, oh, that movie was garbage. I'm just not going to vote for it for anything. What? But you gotta, you know, then you're like, that movie had amazing cinematography, or the score of that movie was just outrageously good. Yeah, it stunk, but it was no, I'm not going to vote for it.
I feel like it's more the reverse, where they love a movie and they're just like, sure, best costume, why not? I love that movie.
That just, definitely happens too. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, it's going to, you know, this is the first time being on the other side. So I'll report back after I go this round through. But
is part of the policy of the Academy, it's like secret ballot, like you can't tell anybody what you voted for?
I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to talk about what you voted for. Yeah. Which is why those anonymous, I don't know if you guys ever see in the trades, I think it's Hollywood Reporter.
Oh, yeah, the quotes from dumb people about movies.
And yeah. Boy, oh boy, it's funny that those people are the ones who are, you know, violating the rules of the Academy are also the ones with the worst opinions.
Wow.
Like, who know the least God. About the movie that they ostensibly
right,
watched.
Right, right. I just don't like this guy. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. It's
speaking of Get Out, there was a lot of good ones with Get Out. Like, what does this movie have to do with race?
I mean, it wasn't really scary. I mean, a couple scary moments. Oh my gosh, really, people, really? Yeah, I had a great experience of showing somebody Get Out who had never seen it, who had not heard of it at all. And this is after it had won, the awards, and it was such a wonderful experience because they were. Horrified at all the right moments, and we had just a fantastic discussion afterwards, and then like days after talking about it, it's the antithesis of the seven
kids, because they haven't seen anything, and especially for old movies that their friends aren't going to talk about. That's one of my joys, is like never mentioning that a movie exists to my kids until I feel like they're ready to watch it, and then showing it to them. It can still backfire, but it's like, yeah, they don't hear about it. Like, I never mentioned the Ridley Scott or the Alien franchise to any of my children in any context. And I'm pretty sure they never saw anything in pop culture related to it, because they were born too late for like Alien versus Predator stuff to be toys, or their friends don't talk about, like, and just one of those days, like, hey, do you want to watch a movie? And like, all right, hey, let's watch this one. You might like it. So they have no context. And I lay, you know, Alien, the original, on my son. And unfortunately,
oh my God.
As I said, it was a little too early, maybe. I think he probably scarred for life.
I can't wait.
But I think that's, like, he had no idea. He'd never seen an alien. He didn't know what kind of movie it was. He didn't know that it was a franchise. He didn't know who the star was. He'd heard nothing about it. So 13 years of his life, this franchise might not exist. This super important franchise that, like, looms so large. Kind of the same thing with Blade Runner. I'm pretty sure he doesn't know Blade Runner exists at all as a thing, period. And I still haven't shown him that one. I'm still waiting, but like that's something that's one reason to have children. If you wait patiently for 13 years, you can give a kid, you can recreate that experience. Like you guys were mentioning the movie you saw like for the first time on TV.
Yeah.
For me, it was Time Bandits. Yeah. I didn't know Time Bandits existed. I didn't know, like, it just happened upon it on television. And it was like, what?
That must have been so perplexing.
It was great because I immediately knew that I loved it. I'm like, I don't know what this is. All I know is that this is A, different than any movie I've ever seen before, and B, I love it. And so I tried to produce that in my kids, and I you know, didn't get the I love it part right. Probably, you know, gave him nightmares the rest of his life. But I feel
I have a couple quick Time Bandits questions. Did you know the Monty Python crew? Were you in that world yet?
I knew about Monty Python, but I had no, this is the age where I was still not reading the credits and understanding directors. And like, so it was years before I figured it out. Like, oh, I see the association. As far as I was concerned, it was just a weird movie that was on. Like, for some reason, I started associating movies with like the cable network they were on. Like,
sure.
This is a weird HBO movie. Like, HBO didn't make the movie. I don't know. It took me a long time to start associating people with their creative output and making connections like that. So as far as I'm concerned, this was just a weird movie.
And I got to say again, yeah, sometimes these things, you show these things to your kids and it's great when it works. When it doesn't, just like for the recommendations, you're just like, okay, on to the next one. And I've had some really wonderful successes. Time Bandits is one of them. The kids adore that movie and they love how weird it is. Yeah, yeah.
It can be upsetting and scary too. Like you really, really depends.
Very. The parents explode is the last scene of the movie.
And they're in cages in the dark a lot. And it's you know,
it's got nightmarish imagery. And I think that's why they like it. And then another one was like, sometimes you just hit a home run. This is all I've been thinking a lot about kids and introducing movies to them and not letting your own nostalgia, you know, you don't want to build it up a movie up too much to the kid and all this other stuff. Part of it is, for me was introducing them to black and white material early on. Because that once you kind of hit a certain age and then black and white material becomes like, you know, like poison to them. They're just like, I'm not going to waste my time.
Well, it becomes a genre of movie that you don't like or understand. It feels like it's a neutered movie.
So we started slow with things like Three Stooges and stuff like that. But then we quickly graduated to a couple Buster Keaton movies. And we watched City Lights, the Chaplin. And so last night, my wife and I were about to go out. The babysitter comes and the kids were like, oh, let's watch a movie. It was still early enough that they could watch a movie. And I hear my 11-year-old say to the babysitter, oh, we should watch this movie called The General. It's so great. You're going to love it. I'm like, oh, my God. My 11-year-old is recommending a black and white movie to my babysitter.
Did you tell him how they did the train?
It's all practical.
There's no CGI at all. It's backwards. I agree. It's so rewarding to me to come out on a Saturday morning and instead of the screamy shows, instead of like Teen Titans or Gumball, she's sitting down and she's chosen to watch Arrival because she knows that Louise Banks is an excellent mother who's definitely not a monster.
Another experiment that you could run that would take a lot of dedication is to show your children only black and white movies for the first like 5 or 10 years and then show them Wizard of Oz.
Like a Skinner box.
Yeah, and then show them the Wizard of Oz. Like have a giant HD 4K television, but put only black and white content in it for their entire life and until you show them the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, it's so good. Let's watch that Trip to the Moon again.
Woohoo, another Méliès.
Getting back to what Merlin was saying a while ago, or maybe it was Todd was saying about like the you know upsetting things in 80s movies, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons it's been heartbreaking for me because I really want to show my kids the Terminator franchise, but I feel like I don't, you know me, I can't show them Terminator 2 before Terminator 1 because all of Terminator 2's impact relies on you understanding and internalizing Terminator 1. Mm-hmm. But Terminator 1 is not, it doesn't fit with the today's model.
It's very 80s in all the wrong ways.
Yeah. And I don't like, and the thing is, I still think it's mostly a good movie, but only because I understand the context of all of the 80s stuff. And because I think it really is important to meet Sarah Connor in that movie and to internalize the relentlessness of the Terminator. Because you can't enjoy T2 to its fullest without that experience. But I can't show that. So they haven't seen any of the Terminator stuff and don't know anything about that franchise.
I am so dying to show my kid Terminator because she's now way into time travel.
It's a nice feeling to have your daughter watching you sob uncontrollably because a dying robot gives a thumbs up.
She's like, Is that really why you're crying?
Really?
Yeah. Did you watch the first one with her?
I rode the scrubber real hard.
Ooh.
I knew where some of the, I know the, oh, well, no, the roommate, you got to skip. Mm. Heck, hang on.
Mm.
You skip the parts with the roommate and the boyfriend. You got to jump around a little bit.
That long sex scene later.
Well, there's a little bit of sex scenes and there's a couple boobies in Die Hard. They're ephemeral
boobies.
She understands. When they go to the office where the guy's been doing his bumps, she knows the 80s are all about cocaine. I've taught her well. She knows all of that.
But she's got a scar face. She knows all about cocaine.
Yeah.
There's
cocaine all over the streets of San Francisco. Didn't you know that?
Yeah, they're doing it right off the street.
That's everywhere.
Oh, you kidding me? It's a hell of a town.
You know the street value of this mountain?
I don't know that one.
No, we haven't done any R-rated films with the 11-year-old yet.
Even PG from the 80s, just like if they're just not like if you feel if mostly for me, it's not worried about scarring my children or showing. It's mostly I'm worried that they're going to be pulled out of the movie by things that
right.
I don't want to be pulled out of the movie.
Yeah, like you
things that are
up
not part of the storytelling just because they're so incongruous or just not what they're used to, or like, you know, a flash of a boob may not be what they're used to. I don't care that they see it. I care that it takes them out of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
We just watched Back to the Future 3 with both of the kids.
And my daughter adores that movie. That's her favorite of the three.
Wow.
She really likes 2 and 3.
She's ready for Westworld.
It's a natural progression. But
doesn't
I'm
look
not
like
a big,
anything to me.
I'm not a big pauser. I don't want to pause and have to explain things too much. But every once in a while, there's a thing that you got to explain when Marty says his name is Clint Eastwood. I had to pause it and I go, do you know who Clint Eastwood is, hon?
I had to explain Calvin Klein.
Yeah.
So right. Oh, really?
Like, that's still a going concern. You kids don't know, you know.
she was smart enough to have concerns fairly early about her affection for Marty. There's a little bit of Luke and Leia type situation. And we were like, and I was like, it'll work out. It'll work out in the end.
Yeah. But
you're supposed to feel this tension. It's supposed to be slightly uncomfortable, but it's not going to.
The funniest part, this is something that is a thread through so many things where it's funny that, what did we watch recently that, it's going to kill me. We watched something recently because I've been trying to like slowly introduce her to like, especially PG-13 movies that are just, you know, good movies. But it's so funny how she's so suffused in things that have like been on The Simpsons, been like parodied on The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. And she'll see that coming. She's like, oh, like, well, that's where that came from. Which is such a weird feeling. We were so, I mean, like we would be aware of all kinds, as kids, I'm speaking for myself because I'm an old man, but I would be so aware of certain things, even if I hadn't seen the movie. I would know these comedy teams. I would know these bits. I mean, I had never seen an actual Jack Benny show, but I knew tons about Jack Benny and stuff like that. But like for a kid who has like mainlined The Simpsons, there's so much stuff where you go back and go, oh, that's like tonight, Todd, we watched the episode where Artie Ziff wants to rent Marge for the weekend for $1 million. Yeah. And he comes in the helicopter. Yeah,
sometimes they're very, very topical and you need a lot of specific.
Oh, no, that's fine. She knows Artie's a nerd. She's like, this happens every year. I was like, what do you mean? Oh, something with Artie and Marge. It happens every year. But there's a scene here. And the helicopter pulls up and it's a parody of the last scene when BJ has spelled out what, goodbye.
Yeah.
Keep your clothes on.
Yeah. I find when I explain those things to my kids, it doesn't add value.
No, anymore. It doesn't. Like, let me explain. I know you like this cartoon. Let me explain a little bit about the complicated, problematic nature of Wagner. Get a pen.
If it's a joke that doesn't land unless you know the reference, which The Simpsons does a very good job of, if you don't know the reference, especially early, you know, the first decade and a half of The Simpsons, if they're going to do a gag, mm-hmm. and if you don't know the source of the gag, that's okay. It still is funny. But if it falls flat, you know, and you have to know the reference, like the reason I paused to tell my daughter who Clint Eastwood was, because there's going to be a lot of comedy around this name Clint Eastwood. And, if you know that's the origin of that comedy.
But even after you explain it, like I find that they don't laugh at it. Like that's why it's all about, like, if you had shown them a bunch of Clint Eastwood movies as a primer for the Simpsons episode, you can't do that. You can't like say,
here's this 3-hour cowboy movie. So you can understand these three guys pointing a gun at each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What 20 years of media do you have to watch before you can watch this half an hour animated comedy thing? Like, you have to pick your battles. You can only do that with a few beloved franchises and say, I will give you the foundation to fully appreciate this so that I don't have to explain anything. Yeah. That you know everything that they're showing here.
I mean, we're not all going to get everything. We're not all going to get every reference and every...
Thank God.
You know, it's okay to let that stuff happen. I try to...
You know, the other thing, Todd, that you and I have talked about, I know you disagree to some extent on this, but I do subscribe somewhat to the idea that things that make us flinch as grown-ups who, A, know what that sex joke means, and B, have anxious feelings about the implications of it with your kid, is a lot of times it is a Westworld situation where your kids just fly right by it. They know it's something that's like, a little bit piquant, but they're not gonna like at least at my kid's age, I don't think she's not zeroing in on that and interrogating the topic as much as my brain is.
You mean like the Ghostbusters?
Why did they do that? So that was in an old version of the script, and he demanded that it stay
it
in.
It is such a it's a dumb useless scene. Gag.
It's dumb.
It is
it's
so
useless.
Dumb.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that. I saw Ghostbusters in the theater and many times after. And you're right. Like it never stuck in my mind as like I just didn't care about that. That's not, you know, it wasn't. It didn't even stick out as much. Like nudity, at least you can tell I'm seeing something I'm not supposed to be seeing, and it's titillating in some way. But I had no thoughts about that scene whatsoever. It's like, get to the part where Bill Murray's funny, right? Like, get
right,
to the
right.
Get to the big stop motion demon dogs.
It's true.
Right?
This man has no. Mm-hmm. He's the hero. He's the hero of that movie.
I haven't rewatched Ghostbusters in years, mostly because I don't want it to be in my memory. It looms large as a very funny thing. I think if I watch it now, I'd be very disappointed.
Well, that was Die Hard. She's a huge. We're all huge fans of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. We've gone all the way around with Brooklyn Nine-Nine several times. And that's why, you know, that's Jake Peralta's favorite movie. So there's so many references that make sense to her now that she's seen Die Hard.
Ghostbusters, I think, I don't know.
It has not aged well. It could not have been more current at its time. But in addition to all the problematic parts, there's so many movies from the 80s that were really of their time. I can't imagine going back and watching Porky's at this point. We talked about that on the Flophouse this weekend.
Oh, really?
It's like, why would you go back? Porky's was the movie for about a year when I was in high school. And I think it was because it was, as the British say, a little bit naughty. And, you know, it had some ding-dong ripping off in it.
But giant like, hit. A huge hit.
From the guy who did A Christmas
Children
Story.
Are monsters. That's why I like that movie.
While we were talking, I put a new movie into my Letterboxd. I just watched The Snowman, and I had to re-listen to...
Oh, is this the one with Mr. Policeman or whatever?
Yeah, I had to re-listen to the Flophouse episode because I, you know, the Flophouse, you can listen to it even if you haven't seen the movie, and it's still fun and enjoyable because those guys are great. But it takes on extra, you know, resonance if you've actually seen the movie. So I'll be happy to re-listen to the Snowman Flophouse, and it did not disappoint. Boy, that Snowman.
Did you ever pick up a copy of Food Fight?
Oh my gosh.
That's a hell of a thing.
You worked on Food Fight. No, but we at Industrial Light and Magic, we do a little thing where we watch a movie every month that's really bad. And we have a little presentation ahead of time.
Oh God, that's so cool.
I made the presentation for Food Fight.
Oh my God.
That movie is just... It.
What do they say? It sounded like Charlie Sheen recorded his lines one take while he was on the toilet.
The Snowman
Eva Longoria is very disturbing, but
the Snowman
with her
is the live action version
cheeks.
Of Food Fight. I almost would recommend people watching The Snowman.
Really?
I saw a friend of mine tweeting about The Snowman, and what she said was like, "It's not a good movie, but a lot of the shots in it are so beautiful. You're like, how is this shot?
I'm gonna do follow up from the Flophouse episode where they literally asked each other like, what if this could be nominated for an Academy Award in any category? What would it be? And they fumbled around and they gave a terrible answer. Poor job, guys. The correct answer is cinematography because it is shot. It is absolutely stunning.
Somebody did their, but there you go, Todd. Somebody did their job right.
Yeah. I mean, the actors are amazing. The director is
Scott
phenomenal.
Fassbender? Oh my God.
It's the director of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and The Right One In. It is. And that's what makes it
You're
so
kidding.
Perplexing.
This is the guy who did Let the Right One In?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes. It is. I don't know. It is absolutely bizarre. This movie, and I don't know, it's worth watching because you're just like, what is this? Not in a Fateful Findings kind of way or The Room kind of way, but you're just like, what is this? Anyway, so that's now in my letterbox.
Act now.
National and international.
National and international government secrets.
That dramatic pause is not doing what you think it's doing.
Man.
Sorry.
He's ripped, shredded like lettuce. We're probably at a point where we should start wrapping up. It's been a long time. Can we?
Do you have any questions for us? If you're constantly yelling at us on the podcast, now's your last chance to interrogate us about anything we need to be yelled at about past podcasts, future podcasts.
No, I really don't.
You have any notes?
You're gonna regret this moment that you didn't ask us something later when you're yelling at your podcast.
Absolutely, I'll be listening to this and going, when I say yelling at it, it's just like, it's me wishing I could be part of the conversation because I really like where you guys take things and I really like the show.
How do you think you did tonight?
3 to 3.5 stars.
Wow. Out of five?
Out of five.
3 to 3.5.
I don't know. Okay. Let's see what kind of editing magic.
Did you succeed at what you intended to do?
Let's see. Yeah.
I'll give you the full Ebert.
Yeah, I think for what I intended to do, I think I nailed it.
You didn't accidentally say Star Trek instead of Star Wars or anything?
Oh, God, I hope not. I hope I didn't screw up that Andre Dawson thing.
Well, why don't we take a break here and wrap it up and say thanks very much to our friend Todd. Very grateful to have you on for our very special member episode. If people want to find your various things that you do, tell people where you would like to be found on the internet.
How about on Twitter? T Vaziri, TVAZIRI.
Anything else, John?
I think we've got it all. Oh, do we want to tell people? Oh, no.
Oh yeah.
We want to promote the member thing, but if they're hearing this, they're already members, so we don't do that, right?
I think you can always give us more money. I mean, you need to look into your heart and say, like, have I done enough for John and Merlin? You know what I'm saying? Like you're sitting around, some of you're just swashbuckling privateers out there stealing the feed and just shucking and jiving. But ask yourself, you know what I put up with? I come in here every other Tuesday. I could be at home eating chicken with my family, and instead I'm being berated by the good cop. You know how hard that is for me? You could support us a little more.
It's pretty tough.
I thought you were going for kneeling in the forest on a bed of fall leaves, looking to your heart. That's what you're going for.
Okay. Fine, right? Give me a minute. Madonna. You too, Radiohead.
No, movie. It's a movie reference, Todd.
It's John Turturro in Miller's Crossing.
Yes, look into your heart.
Yeah. Very nice. He would have got it.
Madonna.